We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're streaming online at will.illinois.edu. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, the story of an agricultural celebrity and an era that our guest, Jane Smith, describes as a time in which agriculture was becoming a science and science was becoming a business. Jane Smith tells the story in her new book, The Garden of Invention, Luther Burbank and the Business of Breeding Plants. Smith says Luther Burbank was the most famous gardener on the planet. He was hailed in the press as the Edison of the garden and the Wizard of Santa Rosa. Between 1873 and 1925, Luther Burbank developed more than 800 new varieties of fruits, vegetables, flowers, nuts, and grains. His plants were developed for home gardens, orchards, and commercial farms. One of his plants, the one that is his best-known claim to fame, is the Burbank potato. Resistant to blight, it was sent to Ireland, where it arrived. It revived, that country's leading crop. Luther Burbank's plant breeding efforts resulted in plants that were more productive and more beautiful than what had been available. They were also tastier and hardier and stretched the growing season. This afternoon, with Jane Smith's help, we'll take a look at Luther Burbank and his times. Jane Smith is an adjunct professor of history at Northwestern University. She's taught on topics ranging from 20th century fiction to the history of public health. She's the author of four books, including Patenting the Sun, Polio, and the Sock Vaccine, which received the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Science and Technology. Her new book, The Garden of Invention, Luther Burbank and the Business of Breeding Plants, is published by the Penguin Press. Jane Smith, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Delighted to be here.
Today, many of us are a little skittish, wary of new plants, of genetic modification. But in Burbank's day, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, people were very enthusiastic about new plants. Why?
Well, I think there were several reasons, and certainly one of them that we've rather lost sight of is the clear recognition that many people had that the available plants were not adequate, or at least could be very much improved. Much of what we eat today, even just a century later, is kinds of varieties of crops that were introduced in the last 100 years, and they've transformed our food supply.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned the potato and the blight that struck Ireland in the mid-1800s. At the time of Burbank's birth, how important was the potato here and in Europe?
Well, the potato as a food crop has a long and checkered history. Many of your listeners probably know, it's a plant that originated in South America, and it's a member of the nightshade family. And like tomatoes, another member of the nightshade family, potatoes were first greeted with enormous suspicion when they came to Europe. And it took literally centuries for it to catch on as a food crop. And it was very much a top-down kind of persuasion. National leaders, generally kings and queens, would introduce the potato and really heartily encourage people to grow it. And in Ireland, there were many crops that were grown, but most of them were for export only. So the potato was the lowliest of crops, and it was the one that was the only thing that the peasants were allowed to grow for themselves. So they had always a bad idea, a monoculture, and not only were they only eating potatoes by and large, but they were only eating one kind of potato. So when that plant was devastated by what's called late blight, there were very few options for them to eat. Now, in the United States, there was a much more varied food supply, but there was always a search for a better potato.
Yeah. The potato brought Luther Burbank a great deal of money and a great deal of fame, but you say he had not been obsessed with finding a better potato. A breakthrough in beets, you say, would have suited him just as well. What made Luther Burbank tick?
Always an interesting question. Let me correct you for a moment, though, because the Burbank potato did not at all bring him a great deal of money.
Oh, it didn't.
It was his first plant invention, and he sold the rights for the grand sum of $150.
Oh, okay.
He wanted $500, but he didn't get it.
Okay.
So even in those days, that was not a lot of money.
No, okay.
No, but it was a great inspiration for him, and he was a young man, and this was his first plant innovation, and he was very excited. He used the money to move from Massachusetts to California, where he thought he would have a longer growing season and a better environment for doing the kinds of experiments he wanted to do. Now, you ask what made him tick, and I think one of the many delightful things about the Burbank story is that he found his vocation in the public library.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the Lancaster, Massachusetts Public Library and read one of the first books that the library had bought when they reopened in a grand new building after the Civil War, and that was a book by Charles Darwin, not on the origin of species, but a later book and one that's much less famous called Variations of Animals and Plants Under Domestication.
Hmm.
Now, this book has never been what anybody would call a popular hit. it's kind of dull. It has enormous number of disparate examples of the ways that plants and animals vary, and a lot of it is the material that Darwin was persuaded not to include in On the Origin of Species by natural selection, because his original plan was to begin that book with hundreds of pages of demonstrations of how things evolve under domestication, artificial selection. But what's fascinating, I think, is that most readers then and now look to Darwin and say this does or doesn't explain how things evolved in the past. Burbank looked at it and said, this is a blueprint for the future.
Hmm.
I can take this and I can accelerate evolution.
Yeah. And when did he begin calling himself an evolutor of plants?
Well, I don't know exactly when he first started using that phrase in conversation, but he ended up putting it on his income tax forms.
Interesting.
When the taxes came in.
Did he think
he had a wonderful sense of language?
Did he think of himself as an inventor?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And would it be fair to say he was self-educated?
Yes and no. He had a fairly good secondary school education. He never quite graduated from what was basically a college prep academy, the Lancaster Academy. His father died, and that was the end of his schooling. But he had a decent, what we would now call high school education. As a plant breeder, however, he was very much self-educated.
He was born in 1849 in Lancaster, Massachusetts, and the area, this is so fascinating, was home to, or had been home to, Johnny Appleseed, Louisa May Alcott, and a young girl who inspired a nursery rhyme.
Yes, that wasn't quite in Lancaster. It was
a few miles away, but
a few miles away. Yes,
yeah.
It was a hotbed, and he also lived very close to where Emerson lived and Thoreau lived while they were still alive. So these were the local celebrities, the local literary people whose works you would read about in the newspaper, who would come to lecture at the town lyceum.
So what was his childhood like?
what was his childhood like? Well, I think that we imagine the 19th century as being a time when people who still lived on the farm had a very rural and close to the soil kind of experience. But in fact, at that time, Massachusetts was the most industrialized state in the Union. And Burbank's family, his father and his grandfather before him, were manufacturers. They made bricks. And the Burbank family farm was mostly a brickyard. Like everybody else, they had an orchard, they had a vegetable garden. But the real product that they were making was bricks. They had clay, they had water, they had a lot of timberland that they used for firing the ovens for the bricks. And the bricks were very important because that's what people needed to build the factories.
Hmm. And so his family was in good condition financially?
They were in decent condition. He was one of 13 children.
Oh.
So things could certainly get stretched.
Yeah. Was there any inkling that young Luther would become a plant wizard?
Well, you know, when you succeed at something, people go back and they start finding signs. So well after the fact, his mother would say, oh, yes, even as a baby, I could quiet him by handing him a flower. And he was always interested in nature, and he liked to take weeds and transplant them in the front yard. But I'm sure if he had become a lawyer, they would have talked how he liked to argue even as a child. And what really everybody in the family and everybody in the world he grew up in expected was that a bright and enterprising young man would become an inventor of machines.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you were supposed to do. It was the age of Fulton. It was the age of Eli Whitney. It was the age of the railroads. New machines, new mechanical inventions were what people were looking for. But Burbank wanted to take that spirit, or I shouldn't even say wanted, he felt compelled to take that spirit of invention and apply it to the garden.
Yeah. It's so interesting to think, to reflect on something that you write in The Garden of Invention, and that is that at the time of Luther Burbank's birth in 1849, new plants were the stuff of fantasy, and people knew more about breeding animals. What did people know or hypothesize about keeping varieties of plants or improving them?
Well, the major form of plant improvement has always been selection, which is that every farmer, every grower, every flower fancier goes through the field and picks what looks like the best-looking plant and saves the seeds. So selecting the best and trying to reproduce those predates history. I'm sure that this is what Adam and Eve were doing as soon as they left the garden, had to take care of their own business. They started selecting. This is what we do. So that's one of the things that was known. But in terms of how plants actually reproduced, it was only in the late 18th, early 19th century that people became aware that sexual reproduction existed in plants as well as in animals. And this was a disputed idea, and it was really only in the early 19th century, not long before Burbank's birth, that it became the established opinion. And what to do with that opinion took a lot longer to figure out. And what's fascinating about Burbank's work is that most of his great inventions came before the popularization, rediscovery, as they say, of Mendelian genetics. So how plants varied, where these variations came from, what characteristics were intrinsic in the plant and which could be changed was really completely unknown.
Hmm. What kind of records did he keep about the changes that he saw, what he observed, and how he manipulated plants?
They were terrible. In a word, he kept garden notebooks, but they were very sketchy. He had some very primitive and very cryptic codes that he would use. He would often turn back to a page months later and start scribbling something else over the original. And I think it's important to realize that when Burbank was doing his work, the professionalization of science really hadn't occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So very few people had the idea of the laboratory, much less the idea of laboratory records. And the idea that you keep careful notes of your experiments and every stage of what you're doing, and particularly that you keep notes of the failures as well as the successes, was completely alien to him.
Yeah.
It wasn't something he was doing. What he was very interested in was discovering the final product that he wanted. So he would keep notes on, oh, excellent tasting plum. Where did it come from? I have no idea. Often he had no idea. He just knew where it was located and where he was going to go back and find it. So those were the kinds of records he was keeping, how to locate the good ones, how to preserve them, how to cross-pollinate them perhaps and see what other good qualities he could create. And the failures, he would just rip them out and have these spectacular bonfires.
Right. Did the patent law of the day affect his record-keeping in that he didn't keep very careful records, that he kept terrible records?
Well, I think it definitely did, because while Burbank was working, there were no patents for living organisms.
Yeah.
So he certainly wasn't keeping the kind of records he would need to present to the patent office. That wasn't an issue at all. And also, he was always, as many people were, worried about idea thieves. So not only did he not have an incentive to keep records for legal reasons, but he had a very strong incentive not to keep records so that other people wouldn't be able to come in and duplicate his work.
Yeah. He must have
had the two of them. The notebooks are fascinating, but very cryptic.
Yeah, he must have had quite the memory.
Definitely. Yeah. He was extremely gifted in remembering his plants, remembering where they were, remembering, though not necessarily sharing the knowledge, what he had done to get them, and also fabulously gifted in spotting something interesting, going through a field of possibly 1,000 different new seedlings and saying, we'll keep these five. Mm-hmm. We'll do that, which is really an amazing talent. And many people would follow him through the fields, not only goggle-eyed amateurs, but professionals too. And they would say, we don't really know what he's doing, but it's working.
Mm.
We don't know how he does this. So that's one of the ways that all these words like wizard and magician became associated with his work, because it was an art and it was an instinct as much as it was a science.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. This afternoon we're talking with Jane Smith. She's the author of The Garden of Invention, Luther Burbank, and the Business of Breeding Plants. The story that Jane Smith unfolds in this book, the story that unfolds in this book, The Garden of Invention, unfolds in the years between the Civil War and the Great Depression. Luther Burbank was a celebrity, an agricultural celebrity, and this is an era that our guest Jane Smith describes as a time in which agriculture was becoming a science and science was becoming a business. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. So how did Luther Burbank breed his Burbank potato, a variant of which we know and love today, the russet Burbank?
Well, in The Garden of Invention, I call this potato his lucky spud, because it really was a combination of luck and foresight. They say that one of the sayings in science is that chance favors the prepared mind. So Burbank was lucky, but he was also prepared because he had read in Darwin that any individual plant had the potential to create many different variants. And most farmers want nothing to do with that. Most growers find something they like and want to keep on growing it, and particularly with a plant like the potato, which is generally reproduced asexually. You divide the seed potato up and plant it in the ground, and new shoots come out, and new tubers grow underground, and that's where you get your potato that's basically exactly like the parent plant. But Burbank saw a seed pod growing on one of the potatoes that he had out in his field. He was trying to establish himself, first of all, as a market gardener, so he was just selling produce for the market. But he saw this seed ball, a very rare sighting, and for most people who don't know anything about growing potatoes, the greens that come up from the ground can have these tiny little seeds that look a little bit like cherry tomatoes. Imagine that. And it's usually completely ignored by anybody who's growing potatoes. That's not where you're going to get your new potatoes from. But Burbank saw this seed ball and, in a very characteristic move, ripped a piece of his shirt up to tie a little streamer around the potato plant so he would know where it was again, went back in a few weeks to see how his seed ball was doing, checked on it several times, and then, to his horror, discovered it had fallen off the plant, spent 3 days crawling on his hands and knees among the potatoes until, most extraordinary, he actually found the thing, saved the seeds, planted them the next year, all 23 of them, and, just as Darwin had predicted, came up with 23 extremely different potato plants. So he looked at the potatoes that were coming out of these plants and chose the two that had the only two that had decent looking potatoes, planted them again the next year, saw one of them had a much larger yield of beautiful big white potatoes with shallow eyes that lasted well, didn't rot, and that became the Burbank potato. So it was a combination of luck and persistence and willingness to experiment in a field that most people weren't interested in at all. The common way at that time of finding new potatoes was to go out and steal them from someplace else.
Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. Incidental point, did Burbank have any relationship with Liberty Hyde Bailey, the Michigan State and Cornell educator who tried to promote nature study and became something of an evangelist for that point of view?
Absolutely.
Yes.
They had a professional relationship. Bailey came out to Santa Rosa to visit Burbank multiple times. He was very interested in his work and in popularizing his work, and especially in his early writings in the 1890s, he often wrote about Luther Burbank and what he was doing because Bailey was very interested in promoting the idea of what was then the progressive garden, new plant breeds, new hybrids, new forms of evolution. And then he, like Luther Burbank, Liberty Hyde Bailey was also very interested, as you say, in the nature study movement. And Burbank was extremely interested in childhood education and in using nature as the classroom. And Burbank wrote a book that was quite the bestseller in its day, which was 1906, called The Training of the Human Plant. I know it sounds absurd, but that was the title.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Speaking of children, he didn't have children, but he believed every child should have the opportunity to realize his or her potential. Why did he become interested in how to raise children? How did that happen?
Well, I think, as always, it was a confluence of various forces. One was that He himself had grown up in a very strict New England atmosphere where most education was done by rote recitation. He started school very early, and even though it was in the little one-room schoolhouse that his father had built out of Burbank bricks, and the teachers, his first teachers were his first his stepbrother and then his stepsister, he still, Luther found it a completely terrifying experience. He hated it. He hated being indoors. He hated having to stand up and memorize things and recite them in front of other students. And when he came to be an adult, he very much wanted a different kind of education. He had an uncle of his who, for a time, lived, shared part of the same farm, who was a geologist and professor of natural history, and he would take Levi Sumner Burbank, and he would take Luther out on nature walks, which the young boy found were much more interesting and much more educational than anything he felt he was enduring in the classroom. So that was one of the forces. And another was that in California, Burbank became associated with various people, most notably David Starr Jordan, who was the first president of Stanford University, who were very interested in eugenics and in questions of how, let's use Burbank's terms, the human plant could be improved. But most eugenicists were thinking that we have to limit reproduction of so-called inferior people. Burbank went the entirely opposite direction and said, no, what we have to do is create ideal conditions for all children to thrive. So he was a very early advocate of state nutrition programs, of nature study for all children. He was very much admired by urban reformers like Jacob Riis, who wanted to do something for the slum dwellers of the city, because Burbank was saying all children need good food, they need clean air, they need healthful exercise, and they need to be in touch with nature.
Did he have failings? What were they?
Oh, of course he had failings. Yeah. Everybody has failings.
Sure. But we've made him sound so darn good so far.
I know. Well, I'm going to start out by contradicting what I just said, because one of the things that's so fascinating about Burbank is the reverence he inspired in other people, where they regarded him as a saint. Now, people very much admired Thomas Edison, but nobody ever suggested that he was a saint. They very much admired Burbank in the same way, and they would talk about his mysterious generosity of spirit and his aura of humility, or not his aura, his humility, his kindliness, his philanthropic personality. And you have to wonder, in ways that we can never discover, really, what it was like to be with him. Other people would say that when you're with him, it's as though you go under a trance, and you come out and you wonder, what was that about? What was it that he was telling me that was so important? It felt so important at the time, and now when I try to reproduce it, I'm not sure what we were talking about. So there was some kind of charismatic personality, but it's also true when you look at Burbank's writing that there was a huge amount of vanity, terrible exaggeration. People who knew him say, well, you look at his records and he talks about how many plants he reproduced and what their economic value is going to be, and a good rule of thumb is to take every number he provides and divide it by 10. So he was clearly given to extravagance about the prospects of anything that he was doing, and he was a salesman, so he was often selling himself and selling his products, and that certainly is a failing. He would possibly overrate the economic and agricultural potential of something that he was working on. This has been known to happen in the garden business.
Yes, it has. Talk with us, if you would, about the attention he paid to marketing.
Well, he was a practical inventor, and he wanted to sell his inventions. And you asked earlier about patents, but the marketing of plants in the 19th century was a very intricate and multifaceted business. There weren't plants, there weren't plant factories, but what there were very early on were catalogs. And seeds and garden plants were just about the first things that were sold by catalog. In fact, the Postal Service had special rates for sending seeds and plants long before they had special rates for any other kind of merchandise. So Sears Roebuck couldn't have existed before the postal system changed its rates for parcel posts, invented parcel posts. But seeds could be sold by the mail much earlier than that. And since he had no patent and no particular means of reproducing his plants in bulk and no particular interest in doing it, what Burbank would do would be develop a prototype and sell it or license it to seed merchants. And what came to me as I was writing The Garden of Invention was that the way to think of this was that the seed merchants were really the venture capitalists of agriculture at this point, because they would buy up a prototype and bring it up to manufacturing scale and then launch it on the market through their own catalogs.
Yeah, and
that's what they were doing. So Burbank did early on sell a number of his products himself through his own gardens and his own nurseries. But as soon as he could manage, he got out of that business and sold to the garden trade, and then they would resell to the ordinary consumer.
Yeah. It was really interesting to read that in his catalog, New Creations in Fruits and Flowers. The cheapest thing, you report in the catalog, was a compact, heavy-blooming seedling rose, HN13, for the bargain price of $150.
And this is in 1893.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. And it obviously is not something that anybody was buying to put in their front yard. This was a plant that would be bought by Burpee, by Jackson and Perkins, by some of the other very large seed sellers and plant sellers of the time, and they would reproduce it. And you noted that it had no name, because sometimes Burbank would give a name to his plants, but the understanding was that when you bought it from him, you also bought the right to rename the plant. I think one of the fascinating examples of that was a plum that he sold to Stark Brothers Nurseries, which was a very flourishing orchard retailer in Louisiana, Missouri, and very widespread provider of orchard fruit trees during the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. And Burbank called it the gold plum, or the golden plum, rather, because it had a beautiful yellow color. And Stark Brothers took it, and their advertising emphasized that they had paid $3,000 for it. It was that good a plum, and they renamed it the gold plum to emphasize how expensive and how rare it was. So what they were doing, and what many other retailers started to do, was take Burbank's fame as a plant inventor and use it as a selling point in their own catalogs, because they could charge a premium for anything that came from Luther Burbank's garden.
I think that's why I thought he made a lot of money on the potatoes, because everything he touched was golden.
No, everybody else made a lot of money on
yeah.
it.
Yeah, okay. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jane Smith, author of The Garden of Invention, Luther Burbank and the Business of Breeding Plants. Listeners, if you'd like to join us, if you've got a question, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign County on line one. Hi.
Hi. This is away from the historical aspect of your study, but in this country, agribusiness is such a powerful force with Monsanto and Cargill and all the large outfits sort of capturing the academia and underwriting programs and on various stations. It seems to me that independent journalists like yourself should be aware that this is the case. Now, I'm thinking that, you know, there's a chance that you might be endowed by a foundation from Monsanto. I mean, it's actually rather exceptional for researchers, but I don't want to be antagonistic, but I just noticed that the American Association of Environmental Medicine has just called for an immediate moratorium on GM foods. Now, this is not plant breeding as characterized by Burbank's work, but there are a lot of groups in this, and particularly the vested agribusiness people that sort of say that it's really not that much different. But we have a group, and the report was done by an Amy Dean that shows that they're GM foods, and there's some suspicion that it has to do with the process that the genes are patched together, but that's neither here nor there. I was just wondering whether your further studies might lead you into sort of more contemporary, and whether you have any opinion on this sort of aspect of the current.
Well, this is really an interesting question, or an interesting bundle of questions, I should say. Let me say, first of all, no, I am not sponsored by Monsanto at all, not in the least, or any other agribusiness organization. And one of my inspirations for writing about Burbank was to try and see how we got where we are now. Let me put it that way, because I think that there seems to be a sort of feeling in many quarters that basically you're either for Mother Nature or you're for Monsanto, and there's a huge middle ground. There was a lot happening in between there, and that's really where I locate Burbank. Now, when you talk about genetic modification, of course, he used cross-pollination, and then in order to evaluate the plants that he was creating in that way, he used selection and he used grafting to accelerate the fruiting of fruit tree fruits and nuts so that he could have results somewhat faster. But he had no idea of the kind of genetic manipulation on the molecular or cellular level that goes on now, and would have been completely astonished, I think, to see it. Now, that's somewhat begging your question of where I stand, or where we all should stand, in terms of how we deal with the possibilities of plant manipulation or any kind of genetic manipulation, really. And it's a very vexed question. I'm not going to pretend that I have an answer. That's one of the reasons I like history. The story is unfolded. I can go back and mm-hmm. look at it and not have to deal with future predictions. But I think that there are a couple of things that are becoming more and more obvious. One of them is that we do need to be examining and probably regulating the kinds of creations that are coming out of the laboratory. Now our knowledge is outstripping our awareness of what we're doing in many cases. But another issue is that a lot of the kind of controversy about genetically modified organisms or about large corporations is really about the consolidation of agriculture and the consolidation of ownership. And that's not a scientific question. That's a political question. It's a really, really interesting one, and it's a really, really important one, but it's separate.
If I might, I gave the name of the organization wrong. It's the American Academy of Environmental Medicine that's called for the moratorium. I think I said something else. You're mentioning the golden plum reminded me of all this hoopla about the golden rice that the industry has through their beneficence spread. It's an insignificant amount of vitamin A, and practices of eating more green plants would add to the health of people around the third world much more efficaciously than breeding it into your rice. So I think that's PR, and it is a complicated, and it does go beyond the science. But I just was worried that since I do hear this call from the GM industry that this is no different than plant breeding and grafting. Grafting sounds like a great thing. I'm going to try it on my grapevines. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. I've got a number of other folks waiting. Let's go next to a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hello. This is a fascinating topic, and I would point out that it was not just plants, but animals as well. From about 1700 or so, there was a succession of plant and animal breeders working usually rather secretively. I know the animal history better, but I know that many of the pioneer breeders, particularly in Britain, but also in this country, kept double books, stud books, and maybe several generations of breeders would keep the methods they employed quite secret. Inbreeding was very important, but they also did surreptitious crossbreeding. I had a friend much older than I when I was a child who told about going to Great Britain in probably the early 1900s, maybe around 1910. And he wandered out across the field looking for the owner of one of the premier Shropshire breeders. And back in the boondocks of his farm, he found a hut, and in the hut there was a Spanish merino.
Uh-huh.
Merinos were not supposedly allowed in England at the time. Afterward, the fleeces of the shrops improved materially. Anyway, you brought up the question of patents, and I think that's very important. Patents may actually serve a purpose, but as they are now constituted, the law is such that it makes it very difficult for the individual plant breeder to function, because he's always in danger of infringing a patent. And these plants can accidentally hybridize, so that there was an incident with the I can't think of the name of the particular pesticide, herbicide, but it's abused widely in both corn and soybeans, and there's a soybean strain which is tolerant to it.
Roundup Ready is probably
Roundup Ready,
what you're thinking of.
You're right.
And, it's a fascinating invention, by the way. This is Roundup is the pesticide, and the for those listeners who aren't familiar with this, and Roundup is the pesticide, and the plant's special versions
adaptation
of both
mm-hmm.
corn and soybeans have been bred to be what they call Roundup Ready, which is to say they are resistant to this pesticide.
Actually,
and you can basically nuke the field, and everything else will die.
Yeah.
Except
actually,
the Roundup Ready.
Actually, it's a herbicide.
An herbicide. I'm so
yeah,
sorry.
That's okay. But I know we've got quite an agricultural audience out there.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to jump in there.
No, and thank you so much.
I've got to wrap up. So the caller, I'm going to say goodbye to you and ask Jane Smith, is there anything else you want to follow up on this caller? And then maybe I'll ask one more question and we're out of time.
Okay. Well, I think that for anybody who's interested in this question of patents and in Luther Burbank, and again, I point this out as a very with very mixed emotions, but when the Plant Patent Act was being debated in 1930, Burbank was already dead, but for a few years, but his name was all over the discussion in Congress, and the argument was, we'll never have another Luther Burbank if we don't give plant breeders the same kind of protection for intellectual property that any other kind of inventor has. And the absolutely unexpected thing to me was that the person who anticipated almost all the kinds of problems that people are considering now, like what if a patented seed falls in your field and grows there? What if something accidentally hybridizes and you're responsible for patent infringement? The person who raised, what if you are a small farmer and you're being trounced by the big manufacturers who have greater resources? The person who raised all these issues was Fiorello LaGuardia, much better known as the four-term mayor of New York City, mm-hmm. but at the time serving in Congress and not at all in an agricultural district, but very curious about and very aware of the implications of what plant patents might bring.
Mm. Fascinating story. Jane Smith, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Jane Smith is the author of The Garden of Invention, Luther Burbank and the Business of Breeding Plants. The book is published by the Penguin Press.
And that was an interview from the AM 580 archives from May 27th of this year. It's 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, and we've got the prices at the close of trade on the commodity exchanges, and here with the numbers on the grains is AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Tom. Here are the numbers as they settled in Chicago at the CME Group this afternoon for the grains and the oil seeds. From the wheat pit, nearby contract was down 10.75 for the September. At a high price today of $4.31, a low at $4.30, settled up on the high. It still was a loss today at 10.75 cents lower, $4.31 September wheat settlement price. The December contract at $4.67 1/4 high, low at 52, settlement price at $4.54, down 13.25, and the March contract at $4.86.5 high, low at 72, settled at $4.73 3/4, down 13.25, and next year's July futures a $5.10 top, bottom at $4.95, settlement price at $4.97. That settlement price for July wheat down 13.75. Kansas City wheat September contract 10.25 lower at $4.56.5 for the lead option September. From the corn pit now in Chicago, a 9-cent loss today in the nearby contract, actually down 9.5. The high at $3.16.5, the low at $3.05, settled on the low in the September, down 9.5 cents for that contract. December futures, $3.20 the high, the low at $3.15 1/4. Settlement price at $3.17 3/4, down 2 cents in the March futures, $3.33 1/4 the high, the low at $3.28.5, settled $3.31 1/4 cents, down a penny and 3/4. May futures in the corn pit, $3.42.5 the high, the low at $3.38 1/4. Settlement price at $3.40.5, down 2 cents. July contract, $3.51 1/4 the high, the low at $4.46 3/4. Settlement price at $3.49.5, down a penny and 3/4. September oats today, $1.95 down 2. December, $2.05.5, 2.5 cents lower. September soybeans now, $9.90.5 the high, low at $9.20, settled $9.25, down 59.5 cents. That's correct. September soybeans down 59.5 cents to settle at $9.25. November futures, though, and most of the rest of the pit were higher on the day. November contract at $9.10 high, the bottom at $8.92, settled at $9.09. November beans 6 cents the gain. January futures $9.14.5 the high, the low at $8.99 3/4. Settlement price at $9.13 3/4, up 3 3/4. In the March futures, $9.19 the high, low at $9.06, settled at $9.18 and a quarter, up 2 3/4. May beans, $9.19 the high, the low at $9.07, settled $9.18, a penny and a half higher in July contract, down a half cent, $9.20 and a quarter, the settlement price for the July soybeans of 2010, the November 2010 contract settled at $9.75, a penny and a half lower, or rather higher on the day. September bean meal futures, $3.39.70, the high, the low at $3.07.50, settled $3.10, down 28 cents. The October, a $283.30 settlement price for the soybean meal, up $2.80. September soybean oil, $33.26, the high, the low at $32.99, settled $33.15, down 21 in the October contract, $33.69, the high, the low at $33.09, settled $33.40, 12 cents lower for the day. That's a look at the numbers from the CME Group. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time this afternoon during the closing mark report, when we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's at Bates Commodities from Normal, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com. Now the numbers from the livestock side of the CME Group. And we begin with the October live cattle contract, which had a high this afternoon of 87.60, the low 86.95, and settled at 87.05. That's down 17.5 cents. December live cattle, the high today 86.97.5, the low 86.40, settled at 86.67.5, down 25. February had a high of 87.60, the low 87.05, settlement price 87.42.5, down 12.5. And next year's April live cattle, the high 89.60, the low 89.25, settlement 89.32.5, down 52.5. Now to the feeder cattle contract. September had a high of 99.30, the low 98.85, settled at the low 98.85, 100 weight, down 32.5. October had a high of 99.35, the low 98.90, settlement 98.92.5, down 40. November feeder cattle had a high of 99.70, the low 99.25, settled at 99.40, down 35. January's feeder cattle had a high of 100 even, the low 99.65, and settled right in the middle at 99.85, up 47.5. October lean hogs opened or traded today at the high for the day 52.20, the low 50.75, settlement 50.95, down 152.5. December had a high of 49.40, the low 48.30, settled at 49 even, down 82.5. February 55.60, the high, the low 54.90, settlement price 55.22.5, down 60. And April had a high of 60.82.5, the low 60.10, settled at 60.40, down 75. And the February pork belly contract had a high today of 88.20, the low 86.55, and the settlement 87 even, down 130. And those are the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM, 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana. I'm Tom Rogers in for Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine. Jason Croft is our technical director. We make way for the closing market report coming up in